Okay, here are some. This is Jane Garvey with Chicago Creative Investors Association. Okay. I'm going to mute the audience, and that should involve everybody. When I finish that, I'm going to ask Bill if you wouldn't mind trying to say something. If it doesn't work, I'll unmute you separate, or I'll get you unmuted.
You're louder.
Bill,
yes.
Would you say
Hi,
something?
Jane. Can you hear me?
I can. You didn't get muted, which is the intent.
Perfect. Great.
That's
great.
Right. And apparently we're going to get to hear the dings of people coming on, so sorry about that.
That's okay. Oh, yeah. I like being popular, Jane.
All right. For everybody on this call, you have signed on to a call, which is kind of a preview for a workshop we're having on the 26th of January with Bill Knoll on extraordinary asset protection and tax savings strategy. And I'm going to introduce Bill. We have had Bill here before for an all day, but since then the government has changed the tax laws, and there are always updates on asset protection as well. So he's going to be speaking here on the 26th of January. Members for that workshop are $59, non-members $79. And Bill, could you please tell our members a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure, Jane. Thanks. And thanks to everyone who's taken the time out to listen to the call this evening. I am both an attorney and a CPA. My original background after graduating from law school was I was a prosecutor and then worked as a litigation attorney for about 15 years, where I really just focused on either suing people or defending people from lawsuits. So that gave me a lot of kind of practical experience in dealing with the things that can happen to landlords as the result of some kind of accident or tragedy or, you know, defect in their product. So then about 12 years ago, I returned to the CPA firm that was founded by my father. And since that time, I've really focused my efforts on representing people from primarily an accounting standpoint in assisting them to minimize their taxes. So the objective, as you alluded to during our workshop, is really to talk about asset protection from several different facets. Really, the first facet is, of course, having the proper entity to give you the best type of protection. And the best entity is also the entity that's going to allow you to pay the least taxes legally under the tax code. And so that's going to be the preliminary focus. And then we're going to transition into a additional or primary focus of how to pay less taxes, especially in light of the very dramatic changes which occurred in December of 2017 that are now effective for your filing of your tax returns in 2018.
Okay. And I would imagine, I mean, President Trump was kind of instrumental in those changes, and being a real estate investor, I would imagine it was the tax laws have changed to our benefit for the most part.
Absolutely, Jane. And I guess I don't know why anyone would be surprised that a real estate investor would make sure that the tax code remains beneficial for those of you who are investing. So, you know, a couple of, you know, big things, really, all of the positives that existed for real estate investors under the tax code in the past have been kept. For instance, you know, having lower capital gains tax rates, also the fact that your rental income or income from capital gains when you sell a property is not subject to self-employment tax or the equivalent of FICA and Medicare tax. The fact that you can still do a 1031 exchange, and by the way, Jane, they changed the tax law so that the 1031 exchange used to apply to other forms of property and investments, And they basically disallowed 1031 exchanges except for real estate investors. So you still have the ability to defer and potentially avoid entirely taxes when you dispose of a property through a 1031 exchange. So then one of the really big, to me, big important things that I think we mentioned offline is there's a new deduction. It's a pass-through deduction that was referred to. It's called the Qualified Business Income Deduction. And during my presentation, I'm going to talk about where that can be applicable to people as a real estate investor. So the Qualified Business Income Deduction is probably the biggest change to the tax code in the past 60 years. And the IRS, well, up until the government shutdown, the IRS was continuing to release what we call guidance or regulations and information about how they were going to view that information. By the way, Jane, probably most people don't realize this. I didn't even realize it until about September, that the IRS has actually changed the way your forms look. Your Form 1040 is going to look different, dramatically different. You know, they promised people that they ought to be able to create their tax return on something the size of a postcard. And so what the IRS did was created 6 postcards, which really are similar to what the old 1040 was. So even looking at a tax return for someone who has been used to it in the past is going to be different this year. So we're going to touch on that as well.
Okay. And I would imagine the government shutdown has some impact on things. I know I'm kind of off on a curve here, but I think the IRS is operating with a much smaller force at the moment. I'm wondering if, are the forms already out that they were supposed to be producing?
Yes. So really, the very vast majority of information has been released. We actually got our tax software, which is not released by the government, but is reviewed by the government. We got our tax software in mid-December with these forms. So the forms are out. You know, with the IRS currently short-staffed, what's happening is, and apparently I just heard this evening that they're going to process returns and include the issue refunds even during the government shutdown is what I just heard this evening. So, you know, the tax return filing season is probably going to begin as anticipated the end of this month or early in February. What for people with tax problems, and, you know, I represent people who have, like, tax issues that need to be resolved, the IRS isn't answering the phone at all for any purpose. So, unfortunately, if there are tax issues, those things can't be addressed at all.
Okay. And I would, they'll be back online to address them later, I would imagine. Just
I think they'll get it done sooner or later because they got to collect the money.
Right. Okay. I am definitely looking forward to this presentation you're giving on the 26th because I think hopefully people will have a little bit of time to look through stuff, anticipate what's happening with them personally, and ask better questions, which
sure.
I don't want to
and you know, Jane, my goal when I do a presentation, and you know, I was, you know, with you guys a couple of years ago, but my goal is not to just drone on like a boring accountant or, you know, boring attorney, but to really have a dialogue throughout the presentation so that we can take questions, we can address particular issues. And, you know, my objective always when I give a presentation like this, I tell people that I want them to become knowledgeable enough, not that they necessarily are going to replace or stop using their attorney or their accountant, but what I say is I want people to become their captain of the real estate ship that they operate and not act as the first mate to either an attorney or an accountant, because I think too many people can get sort of so worried about doing something wrong that they kind of let the advisor decide the business issues and the strategy. And I think that's wrong. I mean, my objective is to educate the students who attend our workshop enough that they'll then be able to evaluate their advisor, their accountant, their attorney, and decide, is this person knowledgeable enough to help me? Or are they trying to use their certifications or their designations or their license as a way to kind of scare me? I know better than you do, so you need to listen to me. Those are the people that you want to avoid. And throughout my presentation, my objective is to make people comfortable to answer the questions. And, you know, the only thing I ask people not to do is ask a question that they think is just for them that isn't going to benefit everyone else in the group. Most of the questions that people ask me during my presentations are questions that I think apply to, you know, at least 20 to 40% of the people in the room, and I'm glad to answer any question like that. So I try to make it, and my objective is to make it sort of a fun and enjoyable experience because, you know, taxes are really probably the biggest expense that your students have, especially as they become more successful and, you know, are earning more profits, earning more gains when they sell properties. You know, the taxes can have a huge impact over your lifetime in how big of a pot of wealth you can grow for you and your family. I know it doesn't sound exciting or sexy, but I'm going to do my best to make it exciting, and I think most people after they finish hearing me in a workshop are really excited to kind of get started understanding a lot of the strategies that, you know, myself and my deceased former associate, Al Ayala, have developed over these years.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I know last time you were here, I really enjoyed your style of presentation. Does come across very informative, but certainly not boring by any means. And you were open to questions, which helps people a lot, because in this particular types of topic, if you get stopped by something, it's hard to continue on with your brain following the train of thought because you've got that question.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. So, I mean, to anyone who's going to come to the workshop, and I'm looking forward to hopefully see lots of people, you have some questions ready for me even before you show up, because I'm glad to take on all comers when it comes to these things.
Okay, that's great. And if people want to go to our website, ccia-info.com, there's a whole page on the workshop. If you look under the events section, January 26th, it says 2018. Probably won't get fixed because I think that'll disconnect links we already have. But it's this January, within a couple of weeks. And there's a whole list of things that Bill's going to be talking about there. One of the things that I'm a little bit curious about, which is not on the list, if you've got some background on opportunity zones, I know some of our members are interested in
I know a little bit about it, and I'm glad to address it during the presentation. The fact of the matter is that is one of the areas where there's very limited guidance been released so far by the IRS. So, you know, as much as I'd like to say, okay, here's what the IRS is saying, what I can say just very briefly is, at this point in time, the IRS is creating what I'm concerned about being a Wild West, because they don't have many rules in place, and the certification requires two people to say, yeah, we're following the IRS's rules. So one of my concerns, I think it's a great opportunity for investors, but I'm worried that they're going to be, I don't know if you remember, but there were, at one point in time, they had the Gulf Opportunity Zones, and there was a lot of sort of, characters that were selling things that probably weren't very good for the investors. And I'm a little bit worried that that might occur in some of these opportunity zones.
I have seen opportunity funds, or I think they're called. So people
exactly.
Are
yes. And yeah. And the other thing is, you know, for people who are interested in creating a fund themselves, the good news is that there really are very few requirements, so that if you've got the experience and really the capacity to make people feel comfortable with your expertise, there's nothing to stop someone from creating their own opportunity fund.
Okay. That's good to know. And I presume that's going probably would be under some of the SEC rules.
That's a kind of a separate matter, but yeah, typically if you've got, if you're raising money from anyone other than what they consider to be friends and family, you know, that the rules apply, but there are exceptions to the rules. Typically, there's a thing called a private placement memorandum, and there's a Reg D exception. So there are ways to raise money even without doing a formal filing, but you got to know the hoops that need to be jumped through in order to be exempt.
Okay, so that's going to apply. Would probably apply there on opportunity zones.
Yes. Certainly.
All right. At this point, I'm going to let people ask questions if they want. Everybody is muted other than Bill and Jane. If you want to unmute yourself to ask a question, you press the star button and a 6, and it will unmute you so you can join the conversation. And I would ask that you remute yourself by repeating that process after your question. Okay, was that somebody unmuting themselves? No, more people joining. Okay. All right. One of the things I'm hoping you'll spend a little bit of time on, because I've got some personal questions about exchanging. I've done exchanges, but my personal experience with that is about 29 years ago was the last one.
Okay.
I did. And we're in the middle of a rent control fight here, trying to save Illinois from rent control. And I'm kind of in the middle of planning my escape.
Right.
Probably the right word, having the trigger half pulled.
Sure.
So I can get out if things get. And by the way, for anybody who's listening, I did have a nice conversation with the minority leader of the House in Illinois last week, and he was very reassuring that this was a non-starter, that the Republicans and the downstate Democrats, there was no way they were going to let it happen. But it's scary that it's even being discussed, that it's being brought up as something that makes no sense, but there are people who think they need to foist it upon us. So anyway, I'm encouraged by that, but I still feel like being up to date on any exchange law stuff is important for all of us that own rental property.
Sure. Well, I mean, for people that don't understand about a 1031 exchange, just in summary, it's selling a property and buying what we would call a replacement property. And there are certain rules that have to be followed, and the most important one is you have to do it through what's called a 1031 intermediary. So in essence, you never get the money in your hands. It's held in essence in escrow by this exchange intermediary, and then you have 6 months to buy a replacement property. And the easiest way to understand it is as long as you buy up. And what I really mean by that is if you sell a property and you net, after the proceeds after costs, okay, not the payment of the mortgage, but just after costs. So if your proceeds after costs are $300,000 and you don't want to pay tax on any gain, you buy a property for $301,000. That's the easiest way to understand it, is you're buying up. But where people get hung up is they think that the payoff of the mortgage has a bearing on that, and it does not. It's not your cash proceeds. It's the actual net sale proceeds. So that's where people can get themselves in trouble.
Yeah, as I recall, you've got to go up and stay the same or go up in mortgage, stay the same and go up in equity.
Yes. And the real thing is, if you put $1 in your pocket, you pay tax on that dollar. Whatever you put in your pocket, so if you were to, in essence, say, oh, I'm selling a property for $300, I'm going to buy a property for $600, but, you know, I'm going to take out a mortgage that is going to allow me to only put $100 down, and I had $200 in my pocket, that's boot. You're going to pay tax on the gain, even though you also bought up. Because you have to look at the debt amount really has to stay the same or go up, and the proceeds on the purchase has to stay the same or go up.
Okay. Yeah, that's sounds like it really hasn't changed much in 29 years.
They didn't. What they did with the rule for 1031 exchanges, they did nothing to real estate. What they said is 1031 exchanges remain available for real estate and for nothing else. That's basically what the law says. So there was no change made. They just limited the use of a 1031 exchange only to real estate.
Okay. All right, so I couldn't take my real estate and go buy a Dunkin' Donuts with it, sounds like.
No, although you could buy, as a landlord, a building that a Dunkin' Donuts rents from. But it's real estate for real estate. And there's not a lot of limitation. Like, you could sell, for instance, a rental property and buy raw land, you know. Or you could sell raw land and buy a rental property. As long as it's real estate for real estate, you've got no problem.
Okay. And the only place I see a potential problem with that is mobile homes, which are, I don't know.
Yeah.
No property or not.
I'd have to, you know, good question. There are cases in the tax court that have gone both way with mobile homes. Some of those cases have said a mobile home is personal property, and other of those cases have said a mobile home can be considered real estate under certain circumstances. There's not a lot of answer to that question. And unfortunately, that's true with this, what I was talking about, the new deduction, the qualified business income deduction. They released 189 pages of regulations, and I can think of 30 questions that were not answered in those 189 pages. And some of this stuff, the answer is, we don't know yet. And, you know, it'll take time for, you know, there to be disagreements between the IRS and taxpayers, and then for the tax court to actually make some rulings. So some of this stuff, unfortunately, when you have a change in the tax code like this, it just takes a while for the real specifics to become known. And, you know, the good news is that gives us opportunities to look at it kind of either way. And when it's uncertain like this, the courts don't penalize people. So you probably take a position either way. And, you know, later we'll have to figure out what happens.
Okay. So it could be a time to be a little bit more aggressive, but
yes, correct.
Realizing you're in the risk of potential audit in the process.
Right. In fact, I will say this. First of all, I can't imagine how they're going to try and audit this thing, number one. Okay. Number two, the staffing at the IRS is incredibly low right now. And audits have been really pretty significantly limited the last couple of years. So, you know, I think as long as you have a reasonable approach, you shouldn't have much of an issue. Ultimately, one of the things I want to educate people in the workshop about is that, you know, there is uncertainty in the tax code, and that, you know, people think that the tax code is written sort of in a group of formulas, and it's not. It's written really in badly butchered English, primarily by lobbyists trying to get some benefit for one of their clients. And the fact that it is written with a lot of sort of ambiguity and uncertainty is really a feature and not a bug. It's what the Congress actually wants. So, you know, the big companies use those ambiguities to their benefits, and my goal is to teach the students that attend the workshop that there are ambiguities that you can use for your benefit. That's what we're going to talk about.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. Any of the rest of you guys have a question for Bill that's coming to mind? All right. I'm kind of thinking at this point, let's remind people we've got workshop with Bill Knoll on the 26th of January, and you can sign up online at ccia-info.com. It's $59 for members, $79 for non-members. And I've got a little note here that you've got a free report for anybody that stays all the way to the end of the workshop. That's how to have multiple LLCs with one tax return and one checking account that you typically would charge $250 for. So
that's right, Jane. So anyone that comes to the event, the workshop, they're going to get a $250 report as part of the program. And, you know, that by itself, I think, is worth attending. As I said, I'm excited to speak to your students. This is really an exciting time to learn about the changes to the tax code. And one of the other things that I'll be pointing out as we're addressing these changes is, you know, how these changes to the tax code might affect the real estate market over the next 2, 3, 4 years as people start to understand how these changes, and they're primarily changes on personal tax returns, not on your tax return as a real estate investor, but on personal tax returns, how that I think might end up impacting, you know, the real estate market and where the real growth is likely to occur. So I'm looking forward to seeing everyone on that.
That is an interesting point, because one of the other things that's very, maybe not terribly unique to Illinois, but Illinois has extremely high property taxes.
Sure.
And I'm living in an area in Glen Ellen, which is the town next door to Lombard, where we typically meet, where the property taxes are driving homeowners out of some of the bigger homes into more moderately priced homes in town.
Right, and that's exactly what I'm talking about, because, you know, under the new tax law, the most that can be deducted on, now this is, again, this is not as a real estate investor, but for an individual filing a personal tax return, what are called your itemized deductions, the most that can be deducted is $10,000, and that's for your income tax and your property tax, all in. So, you know, if you have $8,000 of property tax and then you have another $7,000 of, you know, state income tax, you're not going to get to take the whole write-off. You're only going to get to take the first $10,000. The other $5,000 just disappears, goes poof in the night. And I am in agreement with you that as over the next 4 or 5 years, as people start to realize that, I think that there's going to be a push for really kind of downsizing or moderately sized homes where people all of a sudden say, what am I paying all these taxes for? I can't even get a deduction on them.
Yeah. I've been looking at it as some of the more moderately sized homes. If when we're rehabbing them, we rehab them decked out with higher end finishes.
Sure.
The people selling the million-dollar homes might downsize into a $450,000 home
right.
More happily if it's decked out in the way that they're used to and like.
Yeah, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. I think there's a real opportunity for people to kind of recognize that, because the vast majority of people, it's going to take several years for them to start kind of seeing this, you know. And so especially if, you know, maybe you pick up a property, you fix it up not great, rent it out for 2 or 3 years, then really do it up and sell it and do a 1031 exchange. You got like basically a triple whammy. You know, you've had rental property, you've taken depreciation, you can sell it for a lot of money, and you do a 1031 exchange and don't pay any taxes on it. So I think that there's real opportunities for people that kind of recognize this process.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about the possibility of adding that to the mix there, that you can throw the 1031 in and get your deduction or your exchange.
Yeah, exactly. Don't even pay any tax on it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. It sounds like other people aren't going to ask questions. A little bit shy on the call here, I guess. I do also want to mention to the members, we have a workshop on insurance coming up this Saturday. So while you're on the events page on the CCIA-Invo.com website, you might check into that. I figured this was going to be asset protection and tax January, and insurance doesn't do the whole job, but it certainly helps. So
absolutely, Jane. So yeah, I think that sounds like a great January, Jane. Asset protection and tax. You're going to have to do this every year.
Sounds like a good plan to me. All right, Bill. Well, thank you so much for calling, and I am very much looking forward to seeing you in about 2 weeks.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to seeing you and all of your students. And stay warm and dry there in Chicago, okay?
We will. You too.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
You too.